Chapter 16. At bedtime I was shown into a little dark room by myself. I raised no objections, knowing that I should fare no better after the confidence I had reposed in him in placing my money in his hands. After praying, I laid down not to sleep, but to think of my unsafe position, and listen to the conversation of the stranger and my interpreter, which continued until a late hour, but a few words of which I could understand. My information respecting the treacherous character of this people proved to be without foundation, respecting this stranger at least, for when the morning came and we were prepared to pay him for his farina, he manifested strong feelings of gratitude for the confidence we had placed in him. This opened our way to trade with his neighbors. In my intercourse among this people, who were all Catholics, I found no one to converse with on the subject of religion. I often thought what a privilege it would be to meet with one Christian, and how delighted I should be to spend an hour in an assembly of praying Christians, or hear another's voice in prayer besides my own. I felt such a strong desire for some place of retirement to free my soul and give utterance to my pent-up feelings, that it seemed to me if I could get into the dense forest I should, in a measure, be relieved. A way soon opened before me. With my Bible for my companion, I passed out of the city and followed the seashore until I found an opening into the thick forest into which I entered. Here I enjoyed freedom in prayer beyond anything I had ever experienced before. It was indeed a heavenly place in Christ Jesus. When my business would permit, I used to spend the afternoon away somewhere in these forests, and sometimes, for fear of reptiles, used to ascend a large tree, and fix myself securely in the branches where I enjoyed most precious seasons in reading the Scriptures, singing, praying, and praising the Lord. His precious truth seemed the joy of my soul, and yet, strange as it may seem, I did not then believe my sins were forgiven, but I rejoiced that I was still under conviction. When the time came that I could go again, I felt that I had made much dependence on being there, and I do not remember if ever returning without a special blessing. Oh, how dark it would seem on returning back among the hum and crowd of the people after such precious seasons. The Catholics in Brazil observe their numerous feasts and what they call holy days. While lying in the harbor of St. Catherine's at one of their annual holy days, it was our privilege to witness their indignation against their mortal enemy, Judas Iscariot, for betraying his master. Early in the morning, the Catholic vessels cock-billed their yards, pointing them end upwards to the heavens, and at a given signal at noon their yards were all squared again, and at the outer end of the yard arm of the commodore for the day, Judas, the traitor, was hung in effigy. After waiting a suitable time for him to die, they let him fall from the yard arm into the sea. Then they beat him a while with clubs, and having swung him up to the yardarm again by the neck, once more dropped him into the sea. Thus they continued hanging, drowning, and beating the traitor until their indignant feelings were gratified. He was then towed on shore by the neck, not to be buried, but given into the hands of boys, who dragged him about the public square and streets, beating him with their clubs and stones until he was all used up. We here cleared and sailed with another cargo, and on our arrival in Pariba, we learned that the famine still prevailed. The authorities, learning that we were handing out some of our provisions to feed the starving poor, opened their prison doors to allow their prisoners to come also and beg from us. Being unauthorized by my owners to away their property in this way, I felt reluctant to do it. But I esteemed it a privilege on my account for a while to feed these poor, starving, and almost naked creatures who lingered about our landing place as though it was their only hope from starvation. I did not count them, but I think there were sometimes more than 50 receiving farina at a time. The way they ate it out of their calabashes as they received it from our boat's crew was evidence of their starving state. a poor man from the interior came with a miserable, worn-out-looking horse to buy a few bushels of farina for his family. He said he had come 70 leagues, more than 200 miles. He represented the people and their cattle dying by starvation as he came along. I think he said there had been no rain for more than 2 years. By the time we had disposed of our cargo, the president granted me liberty to import another and gave me a letter of introduction with a pressing request to the president of the province to allow us to purchase a cargo of provisions for Pariba. About this time, Captain J. N. G. Broughton of Marblehead, Massachusetts, arrived in Pariba. These were the first professed Christians that I had known since leaving the United States. With Captain G. Broughton, I enjoyed sweet intercourse during the few days of our acquaintance. It was truly a refreshing season. From the time I made a covenant with God, I had been in the habit of spending all my time before breakfast in prayer, reading the Bible and meditation. This I have since learned to be the best way to commence the day. August 1825, we sailed from Pariba on our fourth voyage. We cleared for Espiritu Santo, or Bay of Spirits, in latitude 20 degrees south. On our arrival there, we encountered some difficulty in finding our way to the anchoring place without a pilot. I did not learn the reason why this place was called the Bay of Spirits, but I think it was the most romantic, wild-looking place I had ever seen. The wind came whistling through the crevices and dark-looking places in the ragged mountains in such sudden gusts that I was fearful our anchor would break its hold before our sails could be furled. Afterward, in passing several miles in our boat to the town and residence of the president, the same wild scenery presented itself. We presented our letter of introduction and special request to the president, but he declined granting our request to purchase a cargo, saying it was contrary to law. I was told that he was shipping farina, and was very glad to learn that Pariba was the best market. We sailed from thence south for Rio, St. Francisco. As we were running parallel with the land at sunset, we could but just discern the land from the masthead. We then shaped our course so as to be gaining an offing during the night. About 8 p.m. we observed the water had become very white. At this time we were rushing onward rapidly under a heavy press of sail. We cast our deep-sea lead from the bow, and to our astonishment we had but 5 fathoms of water, or 30 feet. We immediately hauled on a wind and steered square off the land with all the sail the brig could bear for about 3 hours before we found deep water. During this time we were held in most fearful suspense, fearing our vessel would strike the bottom and dash in pieces when she settled down between the short rushing seas. From our calculations in the morning we found that we were 20 miles from the land, in latitude 21 degrees 30 minutes south, when we first discovered whitewater at 8 p.m. Our book of directions and chart were both silent respecting this dangerous place. We felt very thankful to the Lord for delivering us from this unlooked-for and dangerous position. At Rio St. Francisco, there were so many vessels loading we were unable to complete our cargo, but proceeded from thence to Rio Grande, some 500 miles further south. Here, instead of the lofty, ragged mountains on the seaboard we left at the mouth, were nothing but low sandhills, drifting about by every strong wind like those on the coast of Barbary or the snowdrifts in North America. The sea also drives it about under water in every direction. I was pointed to the lighthouse standing on a dry sandbank and was told that that prominence now was where the ship channel formerly was. Instead of pilots going on board of vessels bound in, as I had always known, we saw a large open boat approaching with pilots and men in her, one man bearing a flagstaff, and others with long sounding poles, requiring us to keep a suitable distance behind them. As they pulled on, feeling for the deepest water, the waving of the flagstaff to steer to the right and left, or to stop, was to be immediately obeyed until they reached the lighthouse, where the pilots step on board the ship and direct them to their anchoring place. The city of Rio Grande lies several miles up the river from the lighthouse. A few years previous to my being there, a violent gale drifted the sand into their city and literally filled their houses with it, some to the first and others to the second-story windows, so that the inhabitants had to flee and build again, some more than a mile distant, where they were then living. It was useless to shovel sand out of their houses unless they could remove it off some distance, the expense of which would more than build them new houses. Thus the old ones were left desolate. The sand was so fine that it found its way into their houses with all their doors and windows shut. This I witnessed more than once while I was there. Subsequently, I remember reading an account given by an English traveler who, on reaching the tongue or shore of the Egyptian sea, penciled in his notebook how easy it would be for God to fulfill the prophecy of Isaiah 11, verse 15. I suppose he saw very clearly that a mighty wind toward the sea would soon drift the sandbanks across it, something similar to the manner of drifting sand as above described in Rio Grande. We made up our cargo at the city of Rio Grande with hides and jerked beef. After skinning their cattle, they strip the flesh from their bones in two pieces and pickle them in vats, some as tanners do their hides. After the salt brine saturates them, they hang them out and dry them on poles, and then roll them up in bundles for the market. In the same manner also they cure their pork, because meat will not keep if salted in barrels in their climate. Back from the seashore, beyond the sandhills, the country formerly abounded with cattle. After a passage of 30 days from Rio Grande, we arrived at Pariba. Here, as usual, we took our pilot from a catamaran, a kind of craft in these parts used instead of boats. They simply consist of from 4 to 8 20-foot logs lashed together with a mast in which to hoist their sail. Sometimes we have seen them almost out of sight of land fishing in the ocean. At a short distance, their appearance is like a man sitting on the water beside a long pole. These logs are of very porous, light wood and soon fill with water and sink to the surface. When they return to the shore, they are hauled up to drain and dry before they use them again. One of our seamen, whom we left here with the smallpox, died soon after we sailed from Pariba. I left him in care of the British consul, who also kindly assisted me in the transaction of my business with the custom house. His chief clerk, a Brazilian, lost a little child about 2 years of age, which was to be buried the evening after I arrived. The consul was among the chief mourners in the procession. He invited me to walk next to him. As I had never witnessed a ceremony of this kind, I readily accepted his invitation. I now had the privilege of learning from him many things relative to the procession, which I desired to know. At about 8 o'clock p.m., two lines of people were formed to march each side of the street. Wax candles, about 3 inches in circumference and 4 feet long, were now lighted and given into the hands of each man in the procession. The corpse, which was richly dressed and adorned with fresh flowers, was placed in a little basket with 4 handles, 4 little boys carrying it. It looked like a sweet little child asleep. The procession, with the priest ahead of the child in the middle of the street, and 2 long lines of men with lighted candles on each side, was rather an imposing sight in the dark night. The walk was about 1.5 miles to an ancient-looking stone church in the upper town. As we passed into the church, I saw one of the flagging stones of the floor raised up, and a small pile of bones and dirt beside it. The consul told me the little child was to be put in there. The child was set down by the altar. The priest occupied but a few moments in speaking, then took up a long-handled cup or ball perforated with holes like a grater, through which, as he uttered a few words, he sprinkled the child with what they called holy water, some of which, whether by accident or otherwise, fell on us who stood at the head of the procession. After this part of the ceremony, all but the child returned in order with the procession. Mr. Harden, the consul, in returning, told me how the child would be disposed of. Two black slaves left with it would strip it of all its clothing, cover it with quicklime to eat off its flesh, then pound it down in that hole with the other bones and dust until the stone would lie in its place again, and they would have all its clothing for their labor. In this way they disposed of their dead in this dilapidated charnel house and place of divine worship. I was told it was one of the oldest towns in South America, being of nearly 300 years standing. After disposing of our cargo in Pariba, we invested our funds in hides and skins and sailed for New York. After a pleasant and prosperous passage of some 30 days, with the exception of cold, freezing storms on our coast, we arrived at the quarantine ground several miles below the city of New York, about the last of March 1826. As we had no sickness on board, I was allowed the privilege on Sunday to take my crew with me to hear service at the Dutch Reformed Church. This was the first religious assembly I had met with since I had covenanted to serve God, and I enjoyed it much. It seemed good to be there. In a few days we were relieved from quarantine, and I was made glad in meeting my companion and sister in New York. My brother F. took my place on board the Empress for another South American voyage, and I left for Fairhaven to enjoy for a season the society of my family and friends after an absence of some 20 months. One of my old acquaintances came in to bid me welcome home again, and very kindly inquired how long it was since I entertained a hope or was converted. I replied that I never had. She was a good Christian and seemed very much disappointed at my reply. My wife had before this endeavored to encourage me to believe that God, for Christ's sake, had forgiven me. I begged her not to deceive me in such an important matter as this. She said that she did not wish to do so, but was satisfied from my letters and diary during my absence that if she was ever converted, I was. I replied that it seemed to me that I should be fully convinced of my conversion before I could rejoice in it. I had fully resolved on my return home that I would erect the family altar. Satan tried hard to hold me back in various ways, but I resolved to commence as soon as we had breakfasted. At this point, one of my former associates, who was very much opposed to experimental religion, called in to see me. At first I felt some misgivings, but conscience and duty prevailed. I opened the Bible and read a chapter and knelt with my family and commended ourselves and friend to the Lord. He looked very sober and soon withdrew. After this victory, I do not remember of ever experiencing any such hindrance again. If I had yielded here, I am satisfied that I should have had more to overcome if I attempted to pray in like manner again. I now had the privilege of religious meeting and Christian friends, and also a weekly prayer meeting at my own house. Elder H., a congregational minister, and particular friend of my parents, invited me to attend an interesting revival of religion then in progress in Taunton, some 20 miles distant. After I had related to him my past experience and was drawing near to Taunton, I requested Elder H. not to call on me to speak in meeting, for I had no experience in that part of the work. In the evening I attended what was called an inquiry meeting of the converts and those under conviction for sin. The pastor of the Congregational Church and Elder H. commenced by inquiring into the state of their minds and asking the converts to state what the Lord had done for them. As this was the first meeting of the kind in my experience, I listened with an unusual degree of interest and attention to learn how all these persons had been converted in so short a time. The simple story of what the Lord had done for them when they felt convicted for sin and were weighed down with a load of guilt and shame, and how they went to the Lord with all their burden and confessed their wrongs and the various ways in which they found relief, some in secret prayer, some in the meeting, others at home, and how God spake peace to their troubled souls, Also, the various states of their feelings when their burdens left them all seemed plain to me. There was such a similarity in this to my experience that I said to myself, "This is the operation of the Spirit of God on the heart through Jesus Christ." After listening a while to these simple testimonies, it appeared to me that I understood the same language, and I began to reason and ask myself, "Is this conversion from sin? Is this really it? Then I have experienced the same. My heart was hot within me. Oh, how I wished Elder H. would then ask me to speak, that I might tell what the Lord had done for me. For something like 18 months I had been unwilling to believe that the Lord had forgiven me my sins, because I had been looking for some evidence or manifestation of His power, I did not know how or in what manner, which would convince me beyond a doubt. My limited views of conversion, and strong desire not to be deceived in this important matter, caused me to overlook the simple manner in which God graciously condescends to pardon the guilty, pleading sinner. After meeting, my tongue was loosed to praise God for what He had done for me so many months before. From this time, all doubts and darkness respecting my conversion and acceptance with God passed away like the morning dew, and peace like a river for weeks and months occupied my heart and mind. I could now give a reason of the hope within me, and say with the apostle, "We know that we have passed from death unto life, because we love the brethren. Old things are passed away, behold, all things are become new." 1 John 3, verse 14, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17.